Well, good morning. I'd like to invite you to turn in your Bibles to the book of Esther. The book of Esther, you'll find it tucked in just a little bit before the book of Job there. Esther is about 10 chapters long, and I preached this last fall to my congregation in 9 sermons. So I'm going to attempt to put 9 sermons into this sermon today. I brought my wife with me. She doesn't like to be centered out at all, so I won't center her out. I'll look over this way and say, she said, boy, oh boy, she said, you need to take a breath, because she said, I've never heard you preach faster. The morning service, I think they got a 40-minute sermon that if you actually slowed it down to normal speed, probably about 85 minutes. So I may edit a little bit today just for your sake. I don't take it for granted that everybody in the room already knows the story about Esther. Now I'm going to try to halfway solve that for you, but you can solve that a little bit by spending some time this afternoon. You can read the whole book of Esther in probably about an hour or an hour and a half. It's a fantastic story. But let me tell you the whole story about Esther really quick, because then we're going to go back and we're going to pick up some themes in the book of Esther that I think are fantastic and worth looking at. So the story of Esther is very interesting. It's the only book in the entire Bible where God is never mentioned by name. Nobody ever says God's name. God is never seen to be speaking. Nobody prays in Esther. Nobody offers a sacrifice in Esther, but they can't, because they're in exile. That means they're no longer in Jerusalem. They're no longer in Israel. The Jewish people have been taken into captivity nearly 70 years earlier already, and are living first in Babylon and then taken over by Persia. This story takes place in a place called Persia, somewhere around what we think of as Iran and Iraq today. So there is no mention of God, but you're going to see God's fingerprints all over this story. There are no propositional truths in this book, which is a big fancy word to mean, instead of preaching this with a whole bunch of sermon points, you've got to tell it as a story. That's the only way you'll understand it, is to hear this story. So here's the story of Esther in 2 minutes. The story of Esther tells how the people of Israel, the Jews, are delivered from their enemies who have sought to destroy them, wipe the entire race out. Just like Hitler tried to wipe out the Jews, there's a man named Haman. He's the bad guy. He wants to kill all of the Jews. He has a particular hatred for them. And it looks like he's going to succeed, but Esther, who is really a nobody, an exile and almost like a slave out of Israel, who rises from being a nobody to being queen of Persia. And her cousin Mordecai, who is just a mere functionary in the government, rises from being a nobody to being the chief vizier, which is like the prime minister, second in control of all the kingdom. And they manage to turn the tide in a particular way, so that rather than the Jews being destroyed, the enemies of God's people are destroyed. And out of that comes a feast that the Jews called Purim, which is the day on which the Jews received deliverance from their enemies. So that's, in 2 minutes, the whole story about Esther, but there's all sorts of stuff that is going on. So if at some point you get lost, that's okay, I'll come back and start over again. I'm going to start over about 3 times over, telling some different parts of the story about Esther. We're going to look at timelines, and it's fascinating to see the 2 different timelines that are in the book of Esther. We're going to talk about family backgrounds or genealogical type stuff, who belongs to who. We're going to talk about conversion in the Old Testament, and then we're going to talk about the moment when everything changes in the book of Esther. And at the very end of that, we're going to try to apply that to our life. Providence, great big word, providence is the doctrine or the teaching, and this is how I'm going to define providence, that our lives are not controlled by fate or by chance. The things that are happening to you, those aren't accidental. It's not just randomness that's out there. Our lives are not controlled by fate or by chance, but by God. And God has purpose in what He's doing. That's providence, and this is the story of providence. So let me talk to you for a few minutes about timelines. The book of Esther begins with these words. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, that's the name of the king, Ahasuerus. They also called him Xerxes the First, but the Jews called him Ahasuerus. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year, okay, you see that? This is the third year of his reign. He gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media, the nobles, the governors of the province were before him. While he showed the riches of his glory and the splendor and pomp and greatness for many days, 180 days. Let's leave the text for a minute. I'll tell you the story. So for 6 months, King Ahasuerus decides to put on display how rich he is, how glorious he is, how powerful he is. 6 months of party. And at the end of it, it culminates with a 7-day open bar in Susa. He says, anybody can come, eat whatever you want, sit on my golden couches, and drink as much wine as your heart desires. And in my experience, when you tell people you can have as much wine as you want, generally they drink more than they should. And so we've got this great big drunk fest going on where King Ahasuerus is trying to display just how powerful, how mighty, how glorious he is. He's been king for 3 years. And the height, the pinnacle of the last day of celebration, when he is really going to display how great he is, he's decided he's going to invite his queen, Queen Vashti, to come in and to display her beauty in front of a whole room of 7-day drunk men. Yeah. And you know what Vashti says? She laughs just like that, and she says, no, I'm not coming. And so Ahasuerus goes from the height of power and pomp and glory to absolute utter shame. What do you mean she won't come? What do you mean she laughed when you called her to come and she won't come? And so his advisors say, this is what you got to do. You got to ban Vashti. She can never come into your presence again, because when our wives hear what Vashti did, they'll laugh at us too. Anyways, we could preach on that, but we'll just move on. That was year 3. We jump forward in chapter 2, 4 years later, to the 7th year of King Ahasuerus' reign. What we know from history is in the 4th year, he suffers a massive military defeat at the hands of the Athenians. He's not having a very good season, and he's banned his wife Vashti from ever coming into his presence. And so his friends have said to him, you know what, here's a great idea. Why don't you build up your harem with a whole bunch of beautiful young virgins? After all, you govern 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia all the way up to Iran. We'll just send our men out and they will just claim all of the beautiful young virgins in the kingdom. This goes on for about 4 years' time, that these women are brought into the harem. They live in one harem. They have a year of beauty treatments. They come spend one night with the king. They go from there to another harem. They never see the king again. It's not the kind of beauty contest you want to be involved in. Okay? There are between 400 and 1,400 women who are carried into this harem. And the chances that this girl, Esther, who is one of those girls, would ever have any hope of turning the king's head in the way she does, it's a mystery, unless you believe that God is in this book, even though he's never named. But she does. In the 7th year of King Ahasuerus' reign, he meets Esther, and he is so taken with her that he says, that's the one for me. She will be the new queen. And so Esther is elevated up, and she becomes queen of Persia in the 7th year of King Ahasuerus' reign. Chapter 3 jumps forward 5 years later, now to the 12th year of King Ahasuerus' reign. So Esther has been queen for about 5 years, and we read in chapter 3, just at the beginning, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Let me just leave the text for a moment and tell you the story. So, this is the 12th year of the reign of King Ahasuerus and Queen Esther has been queen for 5 years, and Haman has now been promoted. The thing I didn't tell you is that her cousin Mordecai, the good guy, has saved the king's life and nothing was done for him. But that'll come up later, don't worry. Haman's been elevated. Everybody's supposed to bow to Haman. Mordecai won't bow to Haman. Haman gets angry, decides that he is going to wipe out all of the Jews, sends out the decree, gets the king to agree to it. The king puts his seal to it. The law can never be changed. Sends out that decree on the 13th day of the first month of the year. The 14th day of the first month of the year for Israel. Every year on the 14th day of the first month of the year, the Jews celebrate Passover. So on Passover Eve, word reaches the Jews that a decree has been signed by the king in Susa to destroy the Jewish race and wipe them from the face of the earth. And Haman is behind this. Why am I telling you all this about this timeline, this third year, seventh year, 12th year? I'm telling you this for this reason. 10 years before Haman designs a plot to destroy the Jewish people, 10 years before Mordecai knows that there is going to be a serious problem for his people, 10 years before anybody is aware that they're going to need deliverance, 10 years before all of that, already God is moving pieces into place. Already Vashti has moved out. Already Esther is coming in. God is at work in all sorts of different ways, in all sorts of ordinary means to put pieces in place that you would never even think to look at and say, that's God moving something into place. That's the long timeline in Esther, 10-year timeline that goes on in Esther. There's also a short timeline in Esther. After Haman makes this decree that all of the Jews are going to be wiped out in a very terrible, violent way, and all of their plunder seized by the people of Persia, Mordecai tears his robes, put ashes on his head, goes out mourning, refuses to be comforted. From the time that we see Mordecai in dust and ashes until the time that we see Mordecai stepping out wearing royal robes with a crown on his head and a seal on his finger as the chief vizier of all of Persia, able to command the nation, 7 days. 7 days. Which tells me not only can God work on these long timelines that you're not even aware are going to happen, but sometimes God works in just an instant to make the change that is necessary to bring about redemption or salvation. So that's one point. That's the timelines. Let me talk to you just for a moment about the backgrounds of these people. And I know you've got potluck, but I trust people plug that stuff in the wall and stay hot. You'll eat. Don't worry. In the book of Daniel, there's these three guys. You remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're brought in, they're told they have to bow down to this golden image, and if they won't bow down into the fiery furnace, they're going to go. And they won't bow down. They say, even if you throw us in that fiery furnace, we still won't bow down. And they won't bow down, and there's a theological reason for that. They say, because that thing is not God, we will not bow to that. Mordecai will not bow down to Haman, but it's not for a theological reason. Later on, we're going to see that Mordecai is willing to bow and show the proper deference to King Ahasuerus. So it's not a theological thing. It's a political thing. Okay, now listen, if you're going to check out of the sermon for a couple minutes, check out of this part. Because this is bonus stuff. This is for the keeners. This is fantastic though. Okay, listen to how Mordecai is described. The first time we meet Mordecai in Esther chapter 2 verse 5. It says, now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jer, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. All right, for the gold medal, what do the names Kish and Shimei and Benjaminite have to do with anything? Anybody? Kish? There we go, gold medal for that man back there. Saul. The first king of Israel was the son of Kish, and his descendant is Shimei, who curses David and throws rocks at him when he's fleeing from Absalom. So the author of Esther is very intentionally giving to us a background of this man Mordecai and saying Mordecai is a descendant of Saul, the son of Kish, the father or the grandfather of Shimei. He's a Benjaminite. Mordecai is in the line of Saul, which means nothing to us until we read about Haman, the bad guy. Chapter 3, verse 1, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. He is Haman the Agagite. Say, what is an Agagite? Well, Agagite is to the Amalekites what Caesar is to Rome, what Pharaoh is to Egypt. It's a dynastic title. The Agag is the king of the Amalekites. And who are the Amalekites? The Amalekites are the first enemy of Israel. When Israel comes out of Egypt, before they get to Sinai, before they get the commandments, while they're at Rephidim, the Amalekites come down and seek to destroy them. And that's where Moses holds up his staff with Joshua and Hur holding up his arms. They drive them back. And God says at that point in the book of Genesis, they are an eternal enemy to Israel and I will wipe them out. And later on, this is important. Like I said, if you're sleeping, that's okay. I'll wake you up in a minute. Okay. Later on, God says to Saul, the king, Saul, in 1 Samuel 15, Saul, go down to Amalek, and there you are to smite the Amalekites. You are to wipe them out entirely, and you're not to touch the plunder. You know what Saul does? Spares the enemies of God, takes the plunder. That's when he comes back, and Samuel comes and says, what is the bleeding of sheep that I hear in my ears, and why is Agag, the king of the Amalekites, still alive and right here in front of me? And Saul makes all sorts of excuses, and Samuel says, this day God has torn the kingdom from you. But listen, this sets up an a lasting enmity between the Agagites and the Jews. And so, Mordecai, the descendant of Saul, and Haman, the descendant of Agag, are facing off in Susa. And there's a reason why Mordecai says, I'm not going to bow down to that guy. I don't care how important you think he is. He's an Agagite, and I'm the son of Saul. So here's one more little bonus piece for you. The reason Saul was in such big trouble and had the kingdom torn from his hands is because God had said to him, Saul, go down and wipe out the Amalekites and don't touch the plunder. And Saul had instead spared the people of Amalek, or at least spared their king, and had taken plunder. Here's the interesting thing. At the end of the story of Esther, when everything changes around, they cannot take away the law. The law that was made was that the people of Persia could come and wipe out all of the Jews and steal their plunder. And so what Mordecai does instead is he just puts a mirror on that and he says the Jews can defend themselves from their enemies. They can defend themselves to the death and they can take plunder on their enemies. But when you get to chapter 9 of Esther, three times over, we hear this. Chapter 9, verse 10, verse 15, verse 16, we hear that the Jews destroy the enemies of God. Haman the Agagite is destroyed. All of his sons are destroyed. All of the enemies of God's people are wiped out. But three times over, we get this line. We see it in chapter 9, verse 10. The 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, is wiped out, but they laid no hand on the plunder. They laid no hand on the plunder. Three times over, we hear that. They laid no hand on the plunder. That's intentional. This is a story of the descendant of Saul and the descendant of the Amalekite Agag, and things are made right where the Agagite is destroyed and the plunder is not touched. All right, now you've got to wake up because we're back to an important part. I want to talk for just a moment about conversion in the Old Testament. Conversion happens in the Old Testament just like conversion happens in the New Testament. It's harder to see. In both the Old Testament and the New Testament, we understand this, that no person is saved on the basis of works. Maybe you're new here, maybe you've never heard this before, if you forget all of Esther, remember this. You cannot work your way to salvation. Because what is required of you in order to be saved is perfect obedience to God's law, and none of you can do that. None of you can obey God's law perfectly. None of you can stand on your own merit or on your own work or on your own effort and say, I've done enough, God, for you to look favorably on me and grant to me eternal life. You cannot do that. You stand condemned by God's law, and so did the people in the Old Testament. And so in the New Testament, here's what we know, that God has sent His only begotten Son, Jesus. Jesus has taken upon Himself my sin and has died in my place on the cross. And having done that, He has paid the debt that is decreed against my sin, and He has fulfilled all the righteousness that is required. And so in a very simple way, what is required for salvation? Not work, not effort, not pulling myself up and doing everything that's necessary, but looking at Jesus and saying, He is all sufficient. He has done everything that's necessary. I trust Him. I place my faith on Him. I say to Him, Jesus, save me. That's conversion in the New Testament. Okay? Conversion in the Old Testament is the same thing, but Jesus hasn't come yet. So how does conversion happen in the Old Testament? It's by faith, not by works, but by faith in the promises of God. God has promised that He is going to send a deliverer. God has given all sorts of signs and symbols in the Old Testament, but it's sometimes hard to see. So I'm going to take a little rabbit trail here for a second and come back to Esther. The grandson of Abraham, Jacob, is not a good guy. You've heard the passage perhaps before, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated. And I say to my congregation every once in a while, I say, what's the question you have when you hear Jacob I have loved and Esau I have hated? And everybody says, why does God hate Esau? You say, it's the wrong question. So the question is, why does God love Jacob? Because Esau and Jacob, they're both equally reprehensible. Jacob is a lying, scheming cheat. Esau doesn't care a thing about God's blessing. They're terrible grandsons, terrible dysfunctional family that Abraham has. And when Jacob, after he cheats his brother out of the blessing, lies to his father and steals the blessing from him, runs away, gets to Bethel. God speaks to him. There's a ladder going up and down, angels on it. God says, I'm going to bring you back to this land. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make you a great nation. Jacob still doesn't get it. Doesn't take that by faith. He says, well, if you will do this, if, then. So he's making a bargain with God. God, if you do these things, he goes away to his uncle Laban, spends 20 years in his own strength doing everything that he thinks he's supposed to do. Gets himself 2 wives, 2 concubines, 12 children, huge flocks and herds, making his way back. And it's on his way back that he hears, Esau, your brother, is coming out to meet you with 400 men. And all of a sudden, Jacob says, I can't beat him. So he divides up his herds, divides up his wives, divides up his children, sends all of them away. Jacob is left alone, and in the middle of the night, the Lord himself comes down to wrestle with Jacob. And it's in that evening, that night, when conversion takes place, and Jacob's name is changed from Jacob, which means cheater, heel grabber, schemer, to Israel, one who contends with God and prevails. And listen, it's not, Jacob does not prevail with God by beating God at a wrestling match. Okay, because if you've ever been in a wrestling match, or any kind of match for that matter, you know that the person that wins is the person that won. Jacob didn't win. He wrestles all night with the angel of the Lord, and at the end of the night, as the sun is beginning to come up, the angel of the Lord simply reaches down, touches the socket of his hip, cripples him for the rest of his life. You can't win a wrestling match if you can't stand. So here's Jacob clinging to the angel of the Lord, saying, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he says, what is your name? My name is cheater, heel grabber, schemer, liar. I've been a cheat all of my life. All I have right now is what I'm holding on to. I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he says, from now on, your name will be Israel. How does he prevail with God? He prevails with God in that moment of prayer where he says, I can't let go of you unless you bless me. We see conversion. I could spend more time talking about Judah, his son. There's a fantastic story about Judah and Tamar where we see conversion. The book of Esther has a story about conversion. Esther does not start out as an ideal role model for young women. Seriously. Daniel determines in his heart that he will not be defiled by the king's food, and so for a great deal of time eats nothing but vegetables because he's so determined that he will not be defiled by this culture, the Babylonian culture he's in. Esther, on the other hand, determines she will be defiled in every possible way. Her cousin Mordecai says, don't tell anybody who you are. And so she goes into this harem for at least a year, and in that harem, she cannot eat kosher. because it would give her away. She can't keep Sabbath because it would give her away. And she cannot keep herself from the king's bed because it would give her away. Some people go, you wreck the story of Esther when you say that, you know? But the thing is, she changes. That famous line where it says, who knows if you have come forth for such a time as this? That's preceded right before by Mordecai basically threatening her, saying, you won't live either. Who knows if you're brought forth for such a time like this? Neither one of these people are great role models. Neither one are covenantly faithful Israelites as we meet them. And yet God works in and through people who don't yet know Him or don't yet trust Him or don't yet believe Him. God works first. And so we see this change come over Esther. She says, at least go and fast for me for 3 days and then I will go into the king. And if I perish, I perish. And we still don't see the change. It's after all of the things have changed, after she has been elevated, given half of all of Haman's lands, or given all of Haman's lands, I can't quite remember right now, and her cousin Mordecai has been made chief vizier, and there's no more danger over her head, that we see her go in one more time on behalf of her people, and she risks her life a second time to go to the king and say, I come to plead for my people. We see conversion in the book of Esther. Now, one last thing is before I come to my conclusion. When does it all change in the story of Esther? This is fascinating. This is the one I want you to hear for sure. The week that begins with Mordecai, torn robes, dust on his head, mourning in ashes, and ends with him in royal robes and a crown on his head with all the power of the empire at his control. What changes? It's not Esther going into the king and the king extending his scepter to her and says, ask of me whatever you will, up to half of my kingdom. That's not when everything changes. It's not when Esther says, well, listen, why don't you come and bring the chief vizier Haman, the bad guy, to dinner with you tonight, and that's what I'd like. That's not when it changes. In fact, everything gets worse after that day. Because on the way home from the first dinner, Haman, going home, having had something to eat, something to drink, feeling pretty good about himself because he was invited to eat with the king and the queen, sees Mordecai, his arch enemy, there, and Mordecai will not bow to him. And it says in the Bible that Haman's face changed and he went home in a fury and says to his wife Zeresh, I can't stand that guy. I can't wait for a year until we get to kill all the Jews. I want him dead now. And his wife says, well, listen, you've got the king's ear. Your stock is very high. Go ask for his head. And so Haman sets about that very night to put a 75-foot-high scaffold in his backyard. And he says, first thing in the morning, I'm going to see the king and ask for permission to hang Mordecai on this gallows. So listen, Esther doesn't know anything about this. Esther is home thinking, tomorrow night, Haman and the king are coming back again, and I've got to figure out what I'm going to say to them. And Mordecai doesn't know anything about this, and the king doesn't know anything about this. Only Haman knows this. So Esther is lying on her bed thinking about the supper that's coming the next night. Haman is lying on his bed watching as the workmen put up a 75-foot-high gallows to make a spectacle of the death of his enemy. What nobody knows is that King Ahasuerus is sleepless in Susa. He cannot sleep. Why can the king of Persia not sleep? Who knows? But he can't sleep on this particular night. Now there's all sorts of things he could have done to go to sleep. He could have sent for warm camel milk with molasses stirred in, drank that, gone to bed, but he doesn't. He's got 400 women in a harem. There's some things he probably could have done, and he doesn't. What does he do? He says, bring to me the chronicles of the kingdom and ascribe to read it. And so they bring in the chronicles of the kingdom and they say, where shall I begin reading? He says, go back 5 years. Why does he go back 5 years? I don't know. But he goes back 5 years and he begins to read. I don't know, maybe he went further than 5 years, but he gets there 5 years ago and he reads a line that says, Mordecai the Jew saves king's life. King Ahasuerus says, what was done for that man? Now understand, King Ahasuerus, who has control of 127 provinces in Persia, is known for giving lavish gifts. One person who saved his life was actually given the governorship of an entire province. You can afford to do that when you're king of Persia. They say nothing was done. Wait, no, says the king.
What was done for the man that saved my life?
You did nothing for him.
Seriously, nothing for him?
The king is now more agitated than ever. He's never going to sleep now because there's a guy that saved my life and I did nothing for him. Meanwhile, as the king is hearing this story, Haman has gotten up as early as he possibly can and is making his way to the king's court. The first lights of dawn are just coming in. He's in the king's court, wants to be the front of the line to make sure that he can ask, King, I have a request of you. I want to hang Mordecai the Jew from a gallows that I built last night in my backyard. And the king says, is there anybody in the court yet? And they say, yeah, Haman, the chief vizier of all the kingdom, has just arrived. He says, great, that's just the man I'd like to talk to. Send him in. Haman receives the word. The king is calling for you. He says, he's up already? That's fantastic. I've got something I wanted to ask him. He goes in. The king says to him, Haman, I'm glad to see you. Here's my question. What should be done for the man that the king delights to honor? Haman thinks, can this day get any better? I mean, yesterday I had dinner with the king and queen. Tonight I'm having dinner with the king and queen. Last night I built a gallows to hang Mordecai on. And today the king wants to know what should be done for the man that the king delights to honor. Who could he delight to honor more than me? And Haman is massively rich, owns vast tracts of land, got 10 sons. He doesn't need anything. He says, you know what would be great? I would love to be king for a day. So here's what you should do, O king. Get myself under control here. You should bring out a royal robe that only the king has ever worn, and bring out the royal charger wearing a royal crown on his head, and put this man in your royal robe and on your royal horse, and get the most important man in all of the kingdom to lead a great parade through the streets of Susa, crying out with a loud voice, this is what is done for the man that the king delights to honor. Haman is so excited that he has almost forgotten why he came so early in the morning to see the king, but the king reminds him by saying the name of the man that he had come to inquire about. He says, Mordecai. Haman says, what did you say? Mordecai. Yeah, I want you to take Mordecai, the Jew, you know, the one that's just outside the gate all the time. I want you to put my royal robe on him. I want you to get my horse, put him on it. Haman, most important man I know, I want you to lead the parade through the streets of Susa, crying out in a loud voice, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Haman thinks, I bet you I can't ask to kill him when I'm done, right? You want to know something? Esther is entirely absent from this chapter. Mordecai appears completely passively, never speaks a word or does a thing. This is the moment when everything changes. This is the moment when everything is transformed, when nobody else is even aware that there's going to be an issue, and God works these things. That's providence. That is, our lives not controlled by chance or fate, but by God, working things according to His plan and His purpose. And so it is that the Jews are saved through God's providential action. This is an unsigned masterpiece. But anybody who knows the author or the artist can't miss who wrote it or how it all came about. Close with this. We live in the 21st century. We live in a time when we see what seems to be the shadow of a gallows going up for Christianity. We see that in Canada. We see that with the whole issue with Trinity Western University, where they were not allowed to make lawyers out of people who had studied at a Christian university. The Supreme Court of Canada said it is more important to protect sexual rights than to protect Christian rights, and we ban Christians from being overtly Christian and being lawyers. Last year, summer grant, job grant process, a looming, you know, you've seen things here. Christians in China saw their churches dynamite to ashes just a couple weeks ago. Now understand, if we teach the book of Esther incorrectly, what you end up with is prosperity theology, which is the idea that what God really wants to do for you is bless your socks off so everything's going to be healthy and happy and easy. That's not the case. You may suffer. You may die. This is not the promise that, hey, your diseases will go away. This is not the promise that, hey, you're going to retire young and early with a lot of money and it'll last for the whole time. That's not the promise that Providence is making. The promise of Providence to the Christian is that God is working out His glory, and that's for our good. But the good that we get from God's glory, most of the good that we're going to experience is going to come when that glory is finally revealed. Let me just close by taking it to the New Testament passage that perhaps best pictures providence, Romans chapter 8. In Romans chapter 8, we hear this passage, Romans 8:28, one of the famous verses from Romans. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to His purpose. And you've probably heard that passage and heard it explained to you that this does not mean that everything that happens to me is good, but that God is working all things together for good to those who love God and are called according to His purpose. Do you know that this passage actually goes on to tell you the good God intends to do for you? It does. It says, and we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to His purpose. For those whom He foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son, in order that He, that is His Son, might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom He predestined, He also called. And those whom He called, He also justified. And those whom He justified, He also glorified. That word called ties all this together. Okay? Going back to verse 28. And we know that for all those who love God, all things work together for good. For those who are called according to His purpose, all things work together for good for those who are called according to His purpose. We jump forward to this place where it says, and those whom He predestined, He also called. And those whom He called, He also justified. And those whom He justified, He also glorified. You want to know the good that God intends to do for all those whom He called? For all those who belong to Jesus Christ? For all of them? The good that He intends to do for you is He intends to glorify you. Not here, not for a little temporal amount of time. You may suffer here. You may have affliction here. You most certainly will have some affliction here. But there is coming a day when we will see Him face to face, and there will be an ever-increasing flood tide of glory that God has prepared for those who love Him. And that is what He has prepared to do and planned to do. That is providence, that God is working out His glory through His people. It's not fate that's in control or chance that's in control. God is in control, and you can trust to that. It's a story of providence. Father, I thank You for this congregation of people. Lord, You alone know all of the things that are at play in their life right now, the suffering or the struggle. Lord, sometimes the questions as to why things are happening the way that they're happening. Father, we trust that we will never be asked to suffer more than Your only begotten Son has suffered for us. And so we pray, Father, that You would give to us boldness and courage in the face of this world to trust to You and look to You. And trust, Lord, that You are in control and that whatever situations You have allowed in our life, Lord, are for Your glory and therefore for our good. Build us up, Lord, we pray, in our faith upon the knowledge of these things. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.